This Advent, we're working through our seven words. These are the seven words that Jesus spoke from the cross that we have recorded in the four Gospels. And so last week, we took the first of them, Father, forgive them, for they don't know what they're doing. And we had a look at the story of Gordon Wilson and the events of Remembrance Sunday in 1987. So we're getting to week two. And these are the words that we were looking at with the young people. From Luke's Gospel, Luke 23, 43. Today you will be with me in paradise. Now, just before we get to this, I want to give you a wee interactive thing. I want you to pick a pal, okay? Assuming you're sitting near someone that you're on speaking terms with. That's good. And I want you to figure out who's going to hell. Make a wee list. So, why do we have trouble thinking about who'd go to hell? Because none of us are perfect. Yeah? Any other reasons? Because you won't want to wish it on anyone. You realize the word for hell in the scriptures is often Gehenna. Do you know what Gehenna was? It was the tip. It's Jerusalem's tip. And they burn stuff there. So when Jesus said the fire never goes out, he wasn't kidding. And the stench and smoke of it was concealed by what went on in the temple. But really, it's Gehenna's the rubbish tip. It's not intended for anyone. So the seven words, we're in week two, and we're going to read from Luke 23. So you may need your phone for this. Luke 23, reading from verse 26. As they led Jesus away, a man named Simon, who was from Cyrene, happened to be coming in from the countryside. The soldiers seized him, put the cross on him, and made him carry it behind Jesus. A large crowd trailed behind, including many grief-stricken women. But Jesus turned and said to them, "Daughters of Jerusalem, don't weep for me, but weep for yourselves and your children. For the days are coming when they will say, 'Fortunate indeed are the women who are childless, the wombs who have not borne a child and the breasts that have never nursed. People beg the mountains, fall on us, and plead with the hills, bury us. For if these things are done when the tree is green, what will happen when it's dry?'" Obviously, Jesus here is prophesying the fall of Jerusalem that will happen in 70 AD. "Two others, both criminals, were led out to be executed with him. And when they came to a place called the Skull, they nailed him to the cross. And the criminals were also crucified, one on his right and one on his left. Jesus said, 'Father, forgive them, for they don't know what they're doing.' And the soldiers gambled for his clothes by throwing dice." Did anyone read Psalm 22 this week? Read Psalm 22. It was on Jesus' mind as all this was going on. And that mentions the dividing of clothes by lots. "The crowd watched and the leaders scoffed. 'He saved others,' they said. 'Let him save himself if he's really God's Messiah, the chosen one.' And the soldiers mocked him by offering him a drink of sour wine. And they called out to him, 'If you're the king of the Jews, save yourself.' And a sign was fastened above him with these words, 'This is King of the Jews.' One of the criminals hanging beside him scoffed, 'So you're the Messiah, are you? Prove it by saving yourself and us too while you're at it.' But the other criminal protested, 'Don't you fear God? Even when you've been sentenced to die, we deserve to die for our crimes, but this man hasn't done anything wrong.' Then he said, 'Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom.' And Jesus replied, 'I assure you, today you'll be with me in paradise.'" Wow. Isn't that something? You see the lead up there? Jesus has nothing of worth from anybody, and yet one opportunity he gets. Right. Let's go back to Mark's gospel that we were looking at with the with the young people from Mark 10 and the story of James and John, because this links in with this perfectly. Mark 10, reading from verse 32. They were on their way up to Jerusalem, and Jesus was walking ahead of them. The disciples were filled with awe, and the people following behind were overwhelmed with fear. Taking the 12 disciples aside, Jesus once more began to describe everything that was about to happen. "Listen," he said, "we're going up to Jerusalem, where the Son of Man will be betrayed to the leading priests and the teachers of the religious law. They will sentence him to die and hand him over to the Romans. They will mock him, spit on him, flog him with a whip, and kill him. But after 3 days, he will..." How explicit's that? Absolutely explicit. Jesus says that the religious authorities are going to hand the Son of Man, which was Jesus' favorite way of referring to himself. "So then James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came over to him and said, 'Teacher, we want you to do us a favor.' 'And what's your request?' he asked. They replied, 'When you sit on your glorious throne, we want to sit in the places of honor next to you, one on your right and the other on the left.' But Jesus said to them, 'You don't know what you're asking. Are you able to drink from the bitter cup of suffering that I'm about to drink? Are you able to be baptized with the baptism of suffering that I must be baptized with?' 'Oh, yes,' they replied, 'we're able.' Then Jesus told them, 'You will indeed drink from my bitter cup and be baptized with my baptism of suffering, but I have no right to say who will sit on my right hand or my left hand. God has prepared those places for the ones that he has chosen.' When the other 10 disciples heard that what James and John had asked, they were indignant. So Jesus called them together and said, 'You know that the rulers of this world lord it over other people, and the officials flaunt their authority over those under them. But among you it will be different. Whoever wants to be a leader among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first among you must be the slave of everyone else. For even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and give his life as a ransom for many.'" There's even another passage that speaks to this. The thing about the cross is that all of the Gospels come alight. They all come alight. Because Jesus has been busy laying the ground with the parables he's been teaching, with all the stuff he's been doing. This is from Luke 22. "For the time has come for this prophecy about me to be fulfilled." And then he quotes straight from Isaiah 53. "He was counted among the rebels. Yes, everything written about me by the prophets will come true." You see, Jesus says in Mark 10, "I have no right to choose who is on my left and my right." You think that's weird? Who is Jesus? God incarnate. Why doesn't he have the authority? Why couldn't he pick who was on his left and his right? I'll tell you why he couldn't pick, because he chose not to. He chose not to. He subjected himself to the worst that the world had to throw at him, in the understanding that the conspiracy of Father, Son, and Spirit would make that the rescue plan for the world. He managed to carry within himself the understanding, as he says, that the religious authorities are going to turn to him, turn him over to the civil authorities, who in a callous disregard for justice will have him flogged and whipped and beaten and crucified, dead, and he will rise again on the third day. Jesus, in Luke's gospel, knows exactly what's going to happen to him, but he hasn't been through it, so he hasn't shouldered it up yet. You with me? When Jesus drinks that bitter cup, what's that referring to? That's Gethsemane. And that cup is full of all the suffering and bile and bitterness and rebelliousness of this world. All the brokenness and the abuse and addiction, all of the stuff that warps what God has made. It's all in that cup. But he hasn't drunk that yet. Not back there in Mark 10. Not even here in Luke 22. But he understood that Isaiah had prophesied that he was counted among the rebels. That starts at Jesus' baptism. Because Jesus didn't need to be baptized because he needed forgiveness. He needed to be baptized to identify himself with broken humanity. It's the start of that person. That's why straight after the baptism, Jesus is out into the desert so personally he can face all the temptation that the enemy has to bring to him and prevail. And so then, having explained this to his disciples, then James and John, all the way through the suffering and dying bit, all they're hearing is Peanuts teacher, you know. They don't hear that. Then they hear, when the Son of Man comes in glory. And they hear that bit and they think, woo, this is it. In other accounts in the Gospels, their mother's involved. The nickname for James and John in the Scriptures is Boanerges, which means sons of thunder. Thunder was their mum. And she's kind of saying, do right by my boys. You know, they've given up fishing for a while. I'm expecting out of you. So James and John decide to make their play, and they say, I want to sit in your right and your left. I want to be like the kind of Duke of whatever and the Earl of whatever. I don't know. They want the places of honor beside Jesus. Ahead of all those other disciples, especially Peter and Andrew, because they were on a rival boat. And Jesus says, you have no idea what you're asking for. You haven't got a Scooby. Pause. Have you ever tried to encourage someone to follow Jesus? Like even yourself. And then you're sort of, oh, it's just so hard trying to get me to follow Jesus. And you realize that Jesus calls us sheep. Anyone here work with sheep? Okay. Now I know you get cute sheep, but sheep are thick. They are not the mastermind of the animal kingdom. As a friend of mine once said, why can't Jesus be the lion tamer and we could be lions? Roar, they're really bright animals. Yeah. Yeah. No. No, 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 no. Sheep. When we're trying to get ourselves to follow Jesus, we often miss this stuff. We go through times of suffering, right? What did Jesus do? Went through times of suffering. Said, if you would come after me, you'll have to take up your cross daily and follow after me. Do you think that's Jesus' way of saying there's going to be tough times? There's going to be tough stuff every day. And where we got this idea that it would be plain sailing? Our rescue is won at the cross. And so, when it came to it, Jesus said this. In Mark 10, he said this, and I wonder if the disciples remembered this, perhaps as they were looking from afar. I have no right to say who will sit on my right hand and my left. God has prepared those places for the ones he has chosen. Who did he choose? Who did the Father choose? And who did Jesus agree would be on his right hand and his left hand when he came into his glory? Two rebels, thieves. There's various descriptions of them in the Gospels. But the Romans were fairly particular about how they did you in. And the whole thing about the cross was it was about humiliation. You need a strong stomach to look at the history of this particular way of crucifying, of dealing with people. And I'm not going to go into the details now because that's for another time. But what you need to know is one of the primary things is that as you withered, as your life strength, that basically you suffocate on a cross. But while you have strength to push yourself up on your feet, you can take a breath. But that can only last a day or so. So people who walked past would see you, and the Romans had a habit of crucifying people on the main roads. It was really hard to bring up your children in that environment, for they would see things that we would, just awful things. And here's Jesus, and on his left and his right. So that suggests that these two were rebels, insurrectionists, people who had displayed some kind of opposition to the authority of Rome. And now the point was being made. You can follow them if you like. Look, here they are. Here they are. But Rome, this is what we do to rebels. Fancy following them? Go right ahead. And so Jesus, here on the cross, on his left and his right, surrounded by two. And not only are these guys rebels, but one of them starts to lay into him. One of them lays into him and represents that kind of anger that we have. Well, Jesus, if you're all powerful, God, if you're good, how come my life sucks? How come things are difficult? How come this has happened to me? How come? How come? How come? And the fact that that's done while Jesus is nailed to a cross, he who had no sin in him, the perfect spotless Lamb of God, and this abuse is being hurled. Everything was hurled at Jesus. He's being told, use your power to get down from the cross. If you truly are who you say you are, save yourself. Indeed, you saved others. You said their sins are forgiven. You allegedly made them get up and walk or healed their eyes or whatever. Now you sort yourself out. And if you can't sort yourself out, well, that just proves you're a big fraud. And we're better off without you. Just another fake Messiah. And here either side, one enemy, but then there's the other guy. And the other guy says, effectively sharp, you don't know what you're talking about. So we are receiving the just penalty for our crimes. No self-pity. No. We did wrong, we're suffering. This guy's done nothing wrong. Turns to Jesus and says, remember me. Remember me. Right above Jesus' head was a plaque saying, King of the Jews. It was even written in a few languages to make sure any passersby would understand it. It was written there in mockery. The Jewish authorities did not like it, but Pontius Pilate, the Roman governor, insisted on it, just for an extra little snip of cruelty. But just like most stuff around the cross, what they didn't realize is they were putting up the information that was true. Remember me when you finally become king, says this other guy. Remember me, remember me. And we know how Jesus responds. You see, the cross is Jesus. It's his coronation. Just think about that for a moment. What's been the apogee of your life so far? When's the moment in your life where you made your greatest achievement, your biggest play, the most memorable day of your life? Jesus shouldering up your sin, your brokenness, my brokenness, the disruption and entropy and horror of this world, shoulders it up, and his moment of coronation is nailed to a cross. King of the Jews above his head, crown of thorns on his brow, and we're one of the two people who's been chosen, recognizing. Today you'll be with me in paradise, he says to this guy. How can Jesus say that? Because he's king. See, the early church understood this really, really, really clearly. We see it in Philippians 2, that he humbled himself and took on the form of a servant, poured himself out, and so God exalted him to the highest place. The incarnation of Jesus wasn't just a matter of like the queen walking through Newton Grange Station to open it. It wasn't just the visit of a dignitary, wonderful as that day was. But this is a world-transforming shouldering up of everything that we cannot sort for ourselves. A broken creation at risk of all ending up in hell. And Jesus manages to plow through a rescue plan. But at the same time, Jesus doing that, this is his coronation. This is the point where he becomes king. And not king of a hill above a rubbish dump outside Jerusalem. He becomes king of the new creation, king of everything that's being remade. King of glory. You sang it this morning, although I'm sure the words trembled out your mouth with barely a second thought. We don't realize what we're talking about, these extraordinary truths that we just hint at in our worship, but they're talking about things that we can barely comprehend. So let's focus briefly on this. Today you'll be with me in paradise. What does that mean? We get a few references to this, but what I want to tell you is that paradise is not our final destination. Do you hear me? I'm about to tell you about something. Where do you go when you die? That's interesting. Up there. Heaven. That's what we get told, isn't it? It's what we tell our kids. But that's a kind of butchered truth. It's sort of true, but it's not really the whole truth. It's not actually the primary thing that the scriptures communicate. There were people who talked a lot about this, but they were philosophers who liked a guy called Plato. They talked about that all the time, about going, leaving the bodily life here and going to heaven, sort of disembodied and stuff. That is not what Jesus' plan is. The guy who's done most work on this recently is a guy called Tom Wright. And he says this, the biblical vision is not so much concerned with life after death, but life after death. Let me explain why this is important. So life after death, the disembodied thing where we're kind of with Jesus, which is lovely, in a garden, extraordinary number of near-death experiences, which we now are getting not just thousands of, but millions of, because we figured out how to keep people's brains alive when their hearts pack up. And they go somewhere. And sometimes they go somewhere where all the higher functioning in their brain has stopped. And they shouldn't be able to produce any experiences like that at all. Which is really troubling for neuroscientists who believe that the brain and the mind are exactly the same thing, instead of the mind and consciousness being something that sit in the swimming pool that is the brain, which would be my view, though, you know, you need to do your experimentation. So after death, where do we go? We go to be with Jesus. But that's not the end of the story. It's not the end of the story. Paul would write this, the trumpet will sound, the dead will be raised, incorruptible, we shall be changed. Brand new heaven and earth. Brand new, split new, new bodies, no arthritis or cancer. All of that stuff gone, no more death, no more decay. A perfectly functioning body. That body you always think you maybe deserved, but never quite got. I like to ask it like this, will there be a first or fourth in the new creation? To which my answer is, well, there's one here, isn't there? Because that word for new, and there's different words you could use for new, I saw a new heaven and a new earth, says John in his vision in Revelation. And that word new is not the word for new completely different, it's the word for renewed. And for all you folks who are brought up with brethren Pentecostals that said that we'll rise up in the sky to go be with Jesus, you're forgetting that what's the new Jerusalem doing? Coming down. We're not leaving to go to heaven. We'll be leaving to go up to meet with the new Jerusalem as it comes down on earth. Now, this is all figurative language, and I don't want to put too much emphasis on the concreteness of it, although I have to tell you that a 1,500-mile cube city can contain a lot of people. That's how big the new Jerusalem is in Revelation. But here's why this is important. Many of the Greek philosophers said this stuff was corruptible and yucky and you need to get rid of it. Jesus says the complete opposite. This stuff is good. God made us good. Bodies are good. How many people here have been asked if there will be pets in heaven? Right, well, okay. First of all, you need to say heaven, shorthand for a new heaven and a new earth. Okay, are there hamsters in this earth? Hello? Who made hamsters? Was it dreamed up by a little committee of teachers who thought their children needed something cute to carry them through the day? No. So, What Jesus is promising to this guy is, today you will be with me in paradise. Today you're going to enter into that place, into my keeping. But the hope that the Jews had was for that, on that day, everything crooked will be set straight. The Psalms, all through the prophets, they're waiting for the day of the Lord when wickedness will be judged, everything will be straightened out, and it'll be renewed. The coming of the kingdom, the coming of the stuff over which God is king. And here's the deal. Jesus said that the kingdom's already here. The stuff that Jesus is king of is already here. It's you. It's me. It's the church. It's whenever hungry mouths are fed, or thirsty people are given water, or folks without shelter are taken in. That's all the work of the kingdom of God. That's where God is king, where the widow and the orphan and the alien in your land are taken care of. Do you hear me? And we're destined for a life after death. It's not just being in heaven with Jesus. It's being part of a functional, societal, wonderful, magical, fantastic. English is not sufficient to describe the glory of what he has prepared for us. As Paul would say in 2 Corinthians, no eye has seen, nor ear heard, nor mind yet conceived the good things for those whom he loves. But that doesn't mean we don't know something about it. New heaven, new earth. And of course, in the biblical vision, heaven's not far away with deaf God, hearing aid God that we all pray to sometime. Heaven and earth are right here. They're made for each other. They're interconnected. As I keep reminding you, we just reach through into the kingdom to bring the kingdom here. That's why we prayed for Hunter to sleep well. And I'm telling you, if you're a mom of a sleepless child, that's a kingdom work right there. Today you'll be with me in paradise. Now, just a wee sidey board for those who are brought up Catholic. One of my great joys is there's people of every imaginable denomination in this church. So if you're brought up Catholic, you might have heard something called purgatory. Purgatory, the idea that you go to a place in between to be kind of sorted out. And I get this. C.S. Lewis said in later life, the older he got, the more he could see the attraction of the idea of purgatory. Because we think, how's this going to be perfected in a heartbeat? But here's the problem with purgatory. I better explain. You understand what purgatory is? We go to a place in between times where we can get sorted out. And actually, some Catholic folks would be praying for people there that they don't have to spend too long there to get themselves straightened out before they go to heaven. And of course, I've explained it's not just about heaven, it's about a new heaven and a new earth. Yeah, well, here's the problem. Had the guy who was, Jesus said, today you'll be with me in paradise, he didn't do anything wrong. What does Jesus say? What's the temporal word he uses? Today. So as far as this guy was concerned, he was going to breathe his last, and then... And if I ever thought there was a candidate for purgatory, there he is, okay? So I'm just saying, don't want to mess with your theology too much, but there's a wee sideboard for our Catholic friends. Said with the greatest of respect, but it does say today. Now, who was here for Stuart and Carol's and David and Yvonne's concert? Thank you so much. I'm glad that more of you weren't here because you missed yourselves, quite frankly. I know you all had other things to do and stuff, but... please, when we do these things, we only do them about once or twice a year, please come. So I was chatting with Carol, and Carol is learning how to paint icons. And this is a Russian Orthodox icon of the crucifixion. Can you all see that? And Carol had been in the Netherlands for about 9 or 10 days in January, starting to paint this. And she drew attention to all sorts of different things. Apparently, these are the bones of Adam down here at the bottom. And you see at the bottom the skull, and there's all sorts of stuff. We could be here for a while. Remember, these are intended to help teach the faith to people who can't read. And then she focused in on the top, and she looked at these angelic beings, cherubim or seraphim probably, because angels in the Bible don't have wings. Just saying. So, there's these cherubim or seraphim or whatever up there, and Carol thought, oh, they're crying, they've got enormous handkerchiefs. Yeah? You see that? They're crying at Jesus being crucified. To which the teacher said, "Oh, no, 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 no. They are holding the tablecloth ready for the marriage feast of the Lamb. Isn't that something?" Even in this old ancient icon, and remember these have been developed over centuries and they are faithfully copied and copied and copied. Even there, at this moment of greatest sadness, the fact is that at Jesus' coronation, they're getting ready for the celebration afterwards. Do you see? It's the topsy-turvy world where leaders become servants and the first become last and the last become first, and the kingdom gets going with this coronation that is the most unlikely coronation, when the one who surrendered all used his power to say, "Father, forgive them, for they don't know what they're doing," and then to say to a rebel who is beside him as a kind of best man or whatever at this particular thing, or some kind of guest of honor, when he says, "Remember me," he says, "Today you will be with me in paradise." I've said this before, I'm going to say it again. Jesus' glory is extraordinary. His grace is extraordinary. And friends, none of us deserve it. Really. At our worst moments, we can be pretty wicked. And even at our best, it can be tainted. Though actually, I'm very fond of, better say all of you. No, very fond of all of you. But when it comes to Jesus' forgiveness, where's the bar? Is it high? How low? I mean, are we talking high jump low, or are we talking limbo low? Friends, we are talking below curb low. The bar for Jesus' rescue is just this: remember me. We're not even... Jesus was great at reading people, but he doesn't even say, "I'm really sorry." He doesn't pray a sinner's prayer. And say, "I'm sorry for all the bad things I've done. Would you come and live in my heart, Lord Jesus?" Yeah, Jesus right there. He could read him like a book. He just says, "Remember me. Don't forget my face. Don't let me go out of existence. Don't let my life be for nothing. I've mucked up. And whatever responsibilities I've had, that's been taken away from me. I've not done it right. I've not won the prize. But just at this moment, would you remember me?" And Jesus, in the agony of the cross, turns to him and says, "Today you will be with me in paradise. You. And if that doesn't cause you to need the woman sitting near you as we pack a hankies, then you've got a heart of stone and you need to wake up. You. So, in closing, the bar is low, the grace is high, the forgiveness is total, but it is absolutely needed. And who needs to hear? I need to hear it. I need to hear it. Some of you are walking around not certain that Jesus' saving love can rescue you from death. And I'm telling you today, if you trust him, he can. And when you breathe your last breath, he will be in that room by his Spirit saying, "Today." And there's others who need to hear this too, because they don't feel worthy. And you and I have a job to say to them that Jesus wants to save you. Carol Stewart read a story recently about a priest who has worked in an inner city, a gangland area, devoted their life to a gangland area in California. And this young woman is speaking to this priest and says, "I don't know if I'll get in heaven. I don't know, because of what's gone through in her life." And the priest says, If you're not there, I don't want to stay. We have no idea how loving Jesus is. And the fact that many of our traditions have turned God into an angry, vengeful, petty-minded, nasty disciplinarian is more a reflection of our frustration and our upbringing and our woundedness than it is of the Jesus of the Scriptures. His love knows no height or depth or breadth or length. It is all enveloping, and there is enough love in Jesus to save everyone. John writes that Jesus once said, "It is God's will that none shall perish." So those of you who are theologically literate are now going, "Oh, hang on a minute, Mark's a universalist. What does that mean? You just believe everybody's getting saved." Well, let me explain. Who's going to hell? Who's going to hell? And my answer to that would be this: nobody who doesn't want to. Nobody who doesn't want to. Well, how on earth could you want to go to hell? Listen to the other thief. If your heart is full of bitterness and mockery and pride and anger, you don't want to be a part of the new creation. It's not going to work. If you're not prepared to surrender to Jesus' love, low as that bar is, then the new heaven and new earth would be hell to you. Is it possible for someone that God created to become so embittered, so crushed, so bound up in the bindweed of their own sinfulness? I have two answers to that. I hope not, but I fear so. And as for the other thief, what we don't know is what went through his mind after he heard what Jesus said to him. And there's still time. And there's always grace. So my question for you is this: who do you need to tell? Let's pray.